I simultaneously have a narrative about Cuba, which is largely something I receive through the American media, which is, you know, the vast overwhelming majority of what Canadians read and watch and listen to is American. So those are two concepts that do exist simultaneously, that this is a tropical paradise where my dollar spends well, and also that this is a horrible, repressive place that people are dying in the ocean to flee, where there's no real freedom and people are starving. I think that the way that those ideas are able to coexist are through a rationalization that it wouldn't do Cubans any good to not go to these resorts. In fact, perhaps we're even helping by doing that. And I think that those ideas are allowed to coexist or able to coexist because I have never been forced to actually witness, or have I chosen to witness any of these, you know, either human rights abuses or this poverty that I know exists firsthand. And I think that part of what Canadians buy when they buy these vacation packages is a curated experience that keeps those sites away from us. So I recognize as I answer your question how feeble an answer it is, but I think that probably is the answer about how those things are able to happen at the same time.
I guess I would advise you that the next time you go to Cuba, go to a private lodge, like a private apartment, like an Airbnb, something like that. And you will be supporting Cubans much more.
Uh-huh.
I do want the private sector in Cuba to grow, to become stronger, so we can be an agent of change, because we want to see change in our country. And we are very, 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 very limited by the government. So anytime a Canadian has the opportunity or wants to visit Cuba, if they can say, you know, I'm not going to the all-inclusive, I want to meet the Cubans, I want to talk to them, I'm going to stay at the private house, I'm going to eat at private restaurants, and I'm going to really and fully support them. That would be my advice to you and all Canadians listening to us.
I think that's really good advice, and that's some of the best travel advice I've received. Let me ask you this. Canadians have been going on vacations to Cuba, and largely they are marketed as budget vacations to Cuba for decades. What do they think of Canadians? I have an image in my head about Cubans. What is the image that Cubans have of Canadians?
I think the best way to tell you about this is back in 2015, 16 maybe, I was also in Varadero, in an all-inclusive hotel, mm-hmm. and I met a couple of Canadians over there who were playing pool, you know, and they told me that this was their fifth trip to Cuba. I said, oh, wow, so you like Cuba a lot. So what do you think about Havana, you know, Camagüey, Trinidad? Yeah, we don't know about that. What do you mean? No, yeah, we get a plane, we arrive to the airport, get on my bus, go to the hotel, spend a few days, go back in the bus, go to the airport, and go back home. They don't experience Cuba. They experience a hotel in Cuba, and that hotel could be anywhere in the world. I don't think that would make any difference, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, man, you have been 5 times to Cuba, and you don't know Cuba at all. You don't know anything. So I think because of this, I don't think many Cubans have not a strong opinion, but any opinion at all on Canadians, because they don't get to interact with Canadians, because Canadians don't go to Cuba to interact with Cubans.
These are two countries that have been in contact for a long time, but maybe we haven't yet met each other.
Yeah, very superficial contact, yeah.
Camilo, I have to ask you, when we're discussing the relationship between Canada and Cuba, the relationship between the Trudeau family, and specifically between Pierre Trudeau and Fidel Castro, is one of the like first things that comes to mind. Is this something that Cubans are as aware of as Canadians?
I don't think so. I don't think many Cubans even remember Pierre Trudeau. I don't think so. And I don't think many Cubans are worried about Canadian politics. You know, we are very focus on U.S. politics. Cubans will always know who is the U.S. president, but in the case of Canadians, who we have a lot of Canadians visiting, it's outstanding that we know nothing about Canada, we don't know nothing about you. And for me, this should change, you know.
You know, the fact that Castro was a pallbearer at the funeral of Pierre Trudeau, images of the connection between those two families, there's a bit of a political narrative there of this alliance that's almost a rebuke, almost a middle finger to the states, you know, which is sort of woven into this idea for many years that despite the relationship that Cubans have with the U.S., and there's, of course, a huge Cuban community in Florida and elsewhere, we can go there, but they can't. And you know, Canadians have this access that Americans don't. It's interesting to hear that that's a one-way street that Canadians think about and Cubans don't. I got to ask you, do you know about this very strange conspiracy theory? Do you know about this?
About the...
Go ahead. You say it. Come on.
I've only seen this on U.S. media, okay? you don't get this discussion in Cuba.
What am I talking about? What am I talking about?
The song?
That Justin Trudeau is the illegitimate son of Fidel Castro. A conspiracy theory which I think has never been mentioned before on Canada Land until I've had the opportunity to speak to a Cuban podcaster. But yeah, it's not part of the Cuban Twitter.
No, it's not. I don't think so. You know, like right now, I'm learning from you that Fidel Castro was a pallbearer at Pierre Trudeau. I didn't even know that. Like, Cubans are not learning about Canada, anything about Canada. You know, we know it's cold and you have birds. That's it. We know nothing more from you.
I could be offended, but really, honestly, why would you? Why would you know these things? There's really no reason for you to. Camilo, to kind of review everything you've told me, you're podcasting on what's left of some initial funding, your acceptability to the government, who have hauled you in for questioning and are listening to what you say very carefully, and the fact that you're allowed to keep doing what you're doing has something to do with the fact that on certain issues, you support the government's point of view. But if at any point in time you change your mind about that alignment, or if the criticism outweighs the support, you could face consequences that, you know, being shut down would probably be the least of what might happen to you.
You got it perfectly. Yeah.
So why do it?
I think I can't stop doing it. I just started the podcast because I had something to say. I wanted to say it. I have, you know, thousands of people who listen to us, who understand what we're saying, who want to see our take on any issues. And I think I owe it to them. I'm always honest about, I'm not suicidal. I know that if someday consequences are too hard for me, I know I will drop this. I'm completely honest about this. But as long as I can do this, I'm going to do it.
Camilo, it's always good to meet a fellow podcaster. Thank you for chatting with me today, and good luck with everything you're doing.
No, thank you for having me here. I'm really glad I had this opportunity. Thank you for having me.
That is your Canada Land podcast. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land, and our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. And our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I am your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication's handled by CFUV 101.9 in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Mike D'Souza, Montreal-based managing editor of The Narwhal and former environment/energy reporter for The National Post and National Observer. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks, Jonathan. Good to be with you.
Today on the show, Meta is clomping around like it owns the place again. Perhaps Canada's famously effective competition bureau can bring it to heel. And when a billion trees don't get planted in Canada, do they make a sound? Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Meta says it will officially end news access for Canadians on its Facebook and Instagram platforms.
It said it would, and now it's pulling the trigger.
The company announced today it's officially starting that process, which will take a few weeks.
News Media Canada, the CBC, and the Canadian Association of Broadcasters, which includes Global News, are urging Canada's Competition Bureau to investigate what they're calling Meta's abuse of its dominant position.
So they're going through with it. Meta, that is. After a few years of prostrating themselves for past sins and abuses and wanting to be seen as a good corporate citizen, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram has cycled back around to not giving a damn about what anyone thinks about their attitude to democracy and has begun blocking the sharing of Canadian news content on their platforms. In response to Canadian government legislation, reads the error message when you try to post a link on Facebook, news content can't be shared. The Facebook pages of news sites appear scrubbed of content, replaced with a stark no post available notice. Over on Instagram, it's a similar deal, even though there aren't generally links, just images. Mike, what's your experience with the Narwhal been in this regard?
You know, we had a warning maybe a few weeks ago with Instagram. We had like a warning indicating that we wouldn't be able to use the platform. And one of our audience engagement editors was attempting to post and was restricted. So we've had that experience. And then, of course, like it seems like earlier this week, complete access has been removed in terms of being able to post directly through the Facebook platform. I think it's still possible to do it through, I forget if it's the ad manager or one of the other tools, but overall is restricted. I did a check yesterday also to look at U.S. outlets, and U.S. outlets are also restricted now, and we can't see them in Canada. So I was looking up like the New York Times, looked up Fox News. I looked up even like a far right site like Breitbart, and I saw that all of them are actually restricted. So it's news in general right now in Canada that users, if they're based in Canada, and I presume if they're not using a VPN, won't be able to access.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, Google was saying it would just be like when Google was threatening something similar, they were saying American sites would be visible in Canada. And I was wondering, well, what's the first Canadian publication going to be that starts like a U.S. mirror site? I didn't realize that about with Meta blocking U.S. as well. Because I guess as long as Elon Musk continues to thrash about at Twitter or X or whatever it's called this week, Facebook seems content that it's no longer the most cartoonishly villainish of the major social networks, despite being the one that's facilitated it. At least one literal genocide. I mean, I've talked before on the show about how their threatened hissy fit, now a real hissy fit, isn't that different from what you see companies at all levels do when they're displeased about something that would affect how they conduct business, whether that's taxation or unionization or, as in this case, regulation with a sort of echoes of taxation. The Online News Act, which passed in the spring and, you know, is yet to be enacted because they're working on regulations, the Online News Act would force them and Google to cut deals with Canadian news publications in exchange for facilitating access to content. And so Facebook has said, fine, we just won't facilitate access to content. Mike, you're more enthusiastic about the legislation than a lot of people who've appeared on this show, and certainly its other host. Could you talk about why you like it? I want to give space for that, first of all.
Sure, yeah, thanks. Yeah, first I'll refrain from labeling anyone as a villain here. And I will, like, say that the legislation itself, I think I would agree with many who say that there are flaws in the legislation, and whether, you know, I'm not saying it's perfectly drafted or written. What I like about it is the intent, the purpose of the legislation, which it says in the legislation itself, it's to enhance fairness in the digital news marketplace, particularly references enhancing that fairness where there is a significant power imbalance between the tech companies and the news businesses themselves. So the legislation has good intent. Whether it gets to where it wants to go and spells that out in the appropriate way, that's, I think, certainly up for debate. Yeah, in general, I support like where we have a system now where you have some large companies that have used content from news sites over the years. They've actually said they wanted it. They wanted to use this content so that its users or their users could have a better experience and a product where they're getting access to more or a wide range of information. Over the years, they use that information to build up their platforms in terms of gathering user data. understanding who people are, just expanding the reach so that they essentially became one-stop shops for anyone searching for any information. And then now that they have access to those users, they're in a position, in a dominant position in the marketplace where perhaps they can afford to just cut off access to that information, and just they're making a gamble that their users are going to stay.
Personally, I have some issues with, I think it was founded on a fundamentally dishonest premise about stealing news, but I think, I mean, it's a redistribution of wealth, and that makes me in favor of it, frankly. Correcting a power imbalance, redistributing wealth from companies that are taking it out of this country in terms of online advertising dollars and trying to put it back into things that are hurting. I am very much in favor of that, even if I have some issues with the premise upon which it was initially constructed. But I'm almost bored of my own opinions about it. But my question, I guess, is now, like, well, what is the appropriate response to what Meta is doing? One of my favorite writers, the American labor reporter and Gawker alumnus Hamilton Nolan, offered a post on his Substack the other day that carried a three-word headline, "Do it f-." For him, the short-term pain to the news industry of news disappearing from Facebook and from Google would be worth the long-term positives of no longer counting tech platforms as middlemen to news, forcing publishers to find new paths to directly connect with audiences rather than what he called the toll roads offered by Meta and Google. I mean, maybe. Another possible type of response is the one offered by the Coalition of News Media Canada, which is the newspaper trade association in Canada, mostly newspaper, as well as the Canadian Association of Broadcasters, which is the group of Association of Private Broadcasters, as well as the CBC. They jointly filed a complaint to Canada's Competition Bureau on Tuesday. Per the Competition Act, if any group of six people, 18 years of age or older, make statutory declarations that they believe a breach of Canada's competition law has occurred, the competition commissioner has to at least begin to look into it. Mike, in this case, I think you were one of the six people 18 or older. What was that like?
I can confirm that I am 18 or older. And yes, I did sign an affidavit on behalf of the Narwhal in support of this, in support of this complaint. Yeah, I think for the reasons that I outlined earlier and that you've touched on as well, like, this is a market issue where there's a dominant player. It's taking action in ways that can harm either current competitors or stifle or prevent others from competing with it. In my opinion, the Competition Bureau should have a look at that. And I was actually interested to see, like, in some of the coverage in the National Post, for example, yesterday, and I think in La Presse as well, both quoted the Competition Bureau saying that they had already started to look at it even before the complaint. So I think they're fully seized with this issue. I mean, it goes beyond Facebook. I mean, you look at, in the U.S., you have the Department of Justice and attorneys general across the country that are also looking at Google, essentially for their dominant control of digital advertising. Google now controls the digital tool that nearly every major website publisher uses to sell ads on their websites. That's a direct quote from the U.S. Department of Justice in their complaint. So I think there's similar issues here with both companies in terms of what they have. I've heard people argue that the legislation might disrupt the free flow of information. I've heard people say the legislation, Bill C-18, the Online News Act, is going to require companies to pay for links. You know, both of those are, based on my reading of the bill, incorrect. There's no mention of the word links in the bill.
I mean, there's no mention of the word links, but I think, let me pull it up.
Yeah, I mean, it requires them to negotiate a fair deal and pay for the use of material or allowing it to be
used. Facilitating access, I think, is how it frames it, or making available news content, which it describes as, you know, could be reproducing a portion of news content or giving access, facilitating access to it, including through index or aggregation, which I take to mean a link. I'm not sure what else that could be. I mean, it's not a payment per link necessarily. I mean, whatever they want.
And I think, like, that is, like, the suggestion that there is you're going to quantify paying for links, and we don't know that will happen. It's not in the legislation. It could be theoretically in regulations, although based on the criticism of this idea of paying for individual links, I would be surprised if that winds up in the legislation. But to the other point about, like, the free flow of information and disrupting the free flow, when you have a major platform that is controlling all the in and out of advertising, when you have a major platform that is controlling how news appears. Like, it's not like 20, 30, 40 years ago when you can go to the library and search for something and then get information that's useful. You're not getting a free flow of information. You're getting what artificial intelligence tells you or is proposing or suggesting to you based on, I think, a principle of, like, it's content that is designed to either be rage-inducing, designed to be polarizing. That is the information that people find on these platforms more often than not. And I don't think that that is a free flow of information or that it's fair to call that a free flow of information.
No, I mean, absolutely. I guess part of the tricky thing is to obtain from the Competition Bureau, it orders, you know, for example, to stop them from doing this and to bargain in good faith. But I guess, what's an example you can point to of where the Canada's Competition Bureau did act expeditiously to address an urgent situation?
I can't think of any. I mean, you know, given the fact that, like, that example I brought up of the U.S., you know, Department of Justice, like, there's no public statements yet that regulators are looking at that in Canada in the same way or advanced to the same level that the DOJ has gone. You know, we know of cases where the Competition Bureau was looking at collusion or price fixing for bread prices at grocery stores. We know of examples of allegations of price fixing for gasoline prices at the pumps. And, you know, in both of those cases, it took like years before investigations started and were concluded. So I'm not enthusiastic about having to wait 10 years for the, if that's the case, for the Competition Bureau to weigh into this.
Yeah, if they start inquiry at all.
You know, to be fair, like maybe they will determine that there is not a violation of the abuse of dominance rules. But I mean, I'd like to see some swift action and like some form of intervention here, or at least providing some certainty about what the rules are or what the rules are not. I'm not sure whether the Competition Bureau has the resources it needs to be able to do that adequately and swiftly.
Yeah, I mean, first they have to decide whether to even have an inquiry. I mean, this is sort of like the preliminary stage where we're looking at it, and then they might decide to have an inquiry and we'll see how, you know, where that might go. Some insight, I was trying to wonder, like, beyond just their slowness and ineffectuality of Canada's Competition Bureau generally, I was, you know, certainly wondering, how does this fit into competition law? Because it clearly is like, I think, how does it fit into the actual laws we have beyond just the bureaucratic structure of it? Vass Bednar, who's an expert on Canadian competition policy. She's at McMaster University. She's often on Ken Land's various shows, including Commons. She had a couple of tweets yesterday saying, you know, I get how it feels like an abuse of dominance, but on what grounds would they have market dominance with which to abuse? You tell me. That's why it could be valuable to pay legislative attention to business behaviors writ large. It's like when Twitter was blocking links to competitors. Is that just content moderation? And she pointed to a Globe column she wrote back in December where she argued that Canada's competition laws aren't really adequate for dealing with behavior that's clearly anti-competitive, like when Musk was blocking all links to Mastodon or other platforms, but which doesn't necessarily meet the current threshold of abuse of market dominance. And I think that seems to be the key thing here, is what counts as market dominance. So like Meta, you know, clearly has dominance in the online advertising business, but is it also in the news business? I mean, you know, they act as a gatekeeper, certainly controlling the flow of information, as you explained. And the complaint points to the Competition Bureau's, you know, guidelines for on this, which says, you know, a company doesn't have to be a participant in a given market for them to exert control over it. So like, you know, Meta does not have to be themselves a news publisher in order for them to have control over the news publishing marketplace. But the bar for that is like, they, you know, the Bureau has to weigh whether alternatives exist, as well as the extent to which a service is necessary to compete. So meaning that, like, presumably if it gets to an inquiry, what the Bureau would look at is, well, is it possible to exist as a news publisher without Meta and all their alternatives to that? And I feel like that seems like an uphill battle.
Yeah. So like, I think a few things in terms of my thoughts on that. Facebook and Google and some other platforms perhaps as well have become de facto publishers of information, or I think that argument can be made. And lawyers can argue various points about what the competition law says or doesn't say. I think the argument can be made that they have become publishers. They have become competitors. If someone is going online to search for information, Let's say they're searching for information about climate change. Let's say they're searching for information about vaccine safety. They might find in a search or in their feed access to various content about those topics. Now, you know, Facebook and Google might say, well, we're not in the news business, or people are searching for stuff. They're not necessarily searching for news. But, you know, Google themselves would say that if someone is doing those searches, they don't count that as the only a fraction of users are actually searching for news. And maybe Facebook uses similar arguments. But if you're searching for that information and the best source of information is credible, responsible journalism, then you are blocking access or restricting access or have some degree of control over access to that material in the marketplace. And so that's an economic issue. And I think that's what our competition laws or antitrust laws in the U.S. are designed or should be designed to look at. Now, this story has been going on, I mean, for a long time with any profitable industry. Whenever regulation gets proposed to put like some limits on the power that they have or that they've been able to develop in the marketplace, if there's been limits placed on or, you know, attempts to crack down on, you know, at the Narwhal, we report on environmental issues. So regulations to restrict pollution, to restrict carbon pollution. Companies argue against that and say it's unreasonable, but those limits need to be there for the larger society. And then, you know, you have a debate about, like, are the individual rights of a company or of a person, their individual right to make money, does that outweigh the rights of the collective? And you know, that's also a political argument or debate that some people will have.
Mike, as you know very well, since you brought several, we'd like to duly note things on the show. What would you like to note duly today?
As we're recording this, I think the Auditor General in Ontario is releasing quite an explosive report.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. Tell me.
So about the Greenbelt, which I think just highlight like the value of reporting, and I'll do a plug for my colleague Emma McIntosh at the Narwhal and Noor Javed at the Toronto Star and many others who did some very important reporting about how the decision was made by the Ontario government to carve out parts of the Greenbelt, a protected area in Ontario, more or less around the Greater Toronto area, and whether, you know, who benefited. They reported on land deals that were struck right before the government announced its decision, where, you know, people bought property for certain amounts and suddenly the value of that land exploded once it was clear that development of housing was possible. So the report today links a political staffer in the office of the housing minister, you know, saying that this staffer was involved in directing which lands would be selected.
Oh, wow.
There's a mention of the influence of developers in discussions between the developer and this chief of staff regarding which lands would be removed from the Greenbelt. So I think, you know, like, you know, if it weren't for that media reporting by the Narwhal, by the Toronto Star, and some other outlets like the Globe and Mail and the CBC also have done some reporting on it, which I would also like to note, you know, that is what prompted a bunch of different investigations, including this AG report.
Mm-hmm. It's the sort of case where, as I'm almost the co-host of Wag the Dog, which is our Ontario politics show, and I think how we've described it is, as journalists, we're not going to directly or outright use the word corruption for all various reasons. But if this were a situation where the Liberals had done the same thing, or the NDP had done the same thing, it's a safe bet that Doug Ford himself would be liberally throwing around the word corruption to describe it. Duly noted. That's Shortcuts for this week. Thanks for joining me, Mike.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jonathan. It was fun.
We are on Twitter /X at CanadaLand. You can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. I will at the very least read everything you send. Where can people find you, Mike?
So it's less and less often that I actually write as an editor now, but you can find content that sometimes I have my hands on at thenarwhal.ca.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Anita Ajofo, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called, syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you for supporting Canada Land.